This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Reach 2013, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 14 and 15, 2013.
Thanks, Steve, for that very kind introduction and for introducing the subject this morning as well, and that is building the infrastructure of our communities. The word itself, infrastructure, is instructive, I think. A word that we're familiar with is infrared. Infrared light is light that cannot be seen, or at least it's a little beyond the visible light spectrum, as we sometimes speak of. And in some ways, that's it gets at the core of this. What are the structural pieces that make missions work, that make a culture powerful, that make a people powerful, that make a church strong? And what are those structures that we do not see? And that's what I would like to talk about this morning a bit. I'm going to begin with a story and end with a story and tuck a couple of passages in between. About 150 miles west of here is a town called Johnstown. And some of you may recall that in 1881, it's a terrible Johnstown flood. Killed somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people. Why did that flood happen? Well, it happened because of the issue we're talking about, infrastructure problems. If you had gone up there to that dam on any typical day, you would have seen maybe the sun shining and you're walking along the breast of the dam and you see this beautiful lake lying to your right and you feel the gentle breeze and everything seems fine. But everything is not fine. And this was precisely the difficulty. Some serious mistakes had been made before the floods came and the wind blew. What were they? Well, somebody had decided to make a little money. So what they did is they removed some of the cast iron conduits that were in that dam to carry away excess water. Sold it to a scrap iron company and put the money in their back pocket and enjoyed the day. A sportsman club who had bought that whole area and had set up shop there, decided they wanted to make sure that the fish stayed in the lake. So they went to the causeway and they built a network across the causeway, the spillway where they were supposed to carry away again excess water if the water got too high. They built that net there, or they placed it there because they wanted to keep the fish in the lake so that they could go fishing when they wanted to. But it was a serious mistake because the day came, the rains fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that dam, as it were, and the water rose. Where was it to go? The debris piled up against that network on top of the dam at the spillway where the water was supposed to go across, and as the debris built up, it dammed it off. The water rose, and it began to trickle over the top. No place to bleed the water off otherwise, but let it go across the top. Now, as a youngster, my friends and I quite often tried to dam off a stream there that flowed through my dad's farm. And I know what it's like when that water starts to go across the top. It's a matter of time. And as you know the story, by and by, that dam gave way. And then the deluge downstream, and thousands of people died. Why? Because somebody had not paid attention to the infrastructure. Three observations I make from this story. First, it was the small things, the seemingly small things, that compromised the integrity of the dam. The truth is in the nuances, not in the big things. We tend to look at the big moments, the big issues, and we need to look at them. But remember something, the truth is in the nuances. Second, once the dam had been breached, there was nothing to do except to flee the deluge, flee to the hills, get to high ground, if you wanted even an opportunity to try to do something with the deluge or as a result of the deluge. Third observation is that Western civilization, seems to me, is past the dam stage. The dam has been breached. The deluge is already upon us. And it seems to me as though in many ways we find ourselves cleaning up the debris. At least in the mission work that I have been involved in, that's what it looks like. It's a good job. And we need to be responsible with it. I want to move on to a couple of pieces here, two passages from the Bible. We do have in focus this morning something about missions. And you could walk around through this building and you'll see a lot of banners, you'll see a lot of brochures, you'll see a lot of stuff. I've been involved in missions long enough to know something. The greatest resource of every mission is its personnel. I repeat it. The greatest resource of every mission is its personnel. I'm actually quoting some famous person, I can't remember his name, who said that the greatest resource of any nation is its people. And it's true. Hats off to the administrators of our schools who saw to it that there are a lot of high schoolers here this morning. And I'm glad you're here. I want to tell you, the future of these missions is dependent on these people sitting in these pews. Greatest resource of any mission is its people. I want to read a passage to you, Matthew chapter 7. I really have only two primary points to make to you. I hope you can remember them. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Probably one of the first songs that we learned as youngsters growing up in our churches was that song, Building Up the Temple, or the one that has to do with this passage, the foundations. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man, which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine, and doeth them not, shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. Infrastructure, foundations. You typically do not see the foundation of a house, a building. But that initial laying of the foundation is so important. And here we're told something about what it means to be successful as a man of God. This comes at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. It's kind of the summary statement. And as I said, as children, the wise man built his house upon a rock. We sang that song. What are the implications? Well, a very, very simple one, I think. For those of us who grew up in Anabaptist circles, we heard this ever since we were small. But I want to share it with you again this morning. Foundational piece for Anabaptist people for years and years and years has simply been doers of the word. Doers of the word. doers of the word within the context of a compelling story. Now, I've been in a lot of discussions about fundamentalism and this and that and the other thing, and I understand the discussion and the arguments, but I do want to say this. One of the differences that I see between typical Christianity and perhaps what has arisen in our circles is simply this: doers of the word within a compelling story. It's amazing how this is. You know, in the book of James, it says, be doers of the word and not hearers only, because you may deceive yourselves. It's fascinating to me how we're made. If we talk about something long enough, and if we actually even tell a few painful stories so we feel it sometime somewhere down in our gut, then we have this, somehow we deceive ourselves into thinking that we really are doing. It's beyond that. The old preacher who told us over and over and over again in his boring way and all of that is still right. And that is, be doers of the word and not hearers only. That's been in our foundation for years. Let's not be so quick to toss it away. You know, in this Sermon on the Mount, and incidentally, for any Anabaptist back in the 16th century, this would have been their favorite passage. They would have said, I don't know all the questions to the theology and all of that, but tell me, what did Jesus say? And if he said it, well, let's just do it. And it may be difficult, and we may get it wrong sometimes, but it's the right idea. If Jesus said it and taught it, let's do it. Let me give you just a couple of categories from the Sermon on the Mount. He did say, enter ye in at the straight gate. I think our brother last night mentioned this passage. Wide is the gate, broad is the way that leadeth to destruction. And few, many there be who go therein. But straight is the gate, spelled S-T-R-A-I-T, which means narrowing. Straight is the gate, narrow is the way that leadeth to life, and few there be that find it. Some accuse us of making the way too difficult. And I agree that perhaps that happens periodically, or at least a misguided narrowing. But I make no apology. Jesus said, the way is straight and it's narrow. And I don't see any reason why we should work at broadening it. Try to make it broad. It's not going to be that way. Second, in the same passage, you are the salt of the earth. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? I don't have time to expand on this a whole lot, but just simply to say this, I make no apology for being different. I really don't. With pride, I hope a right kind of pride, I walk with my wife and my children in Western culture, and we are different. We are weird. I don't mind at all. If the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? This whole notion in missions that we have to make adjustments, all kinds of adjustments in order to accommodate, is a mistaken notion. Now, don't misunderstand me. Anybody who knows me well knows that I have a lot of space to try to make some, build bridges and create ways in which people can be compelled to come into the kingdom. I'm all for that. But let's not forget something. If we throw away the salt, well, where shall it be salted? It goes on to say in that passage, by the way, that it's good for nothing but to cast out and trodden underfoot of men, because it's like everything else. Let's not be so hesitant about being different for God. Third, the Bible says, love your enemies. Same passage, same sermon. Jesus said, love your enemies. We've been right all along on this. Let's not go another direction. I'll never forget a compelling story that I heard of faith builders, David Schenck, one of the I think from MCC, from this community somewhere, I'm not sure where he lives, told us about being invited by the Muslims from Tehran in Iran back a number of years ago to one of their conferences. And after they went to, so MCC sent a delegation there. And somewhere along the line, David asked one of the people who had made the invitation, said, you know, I'm really intrigued. Why did you folks, why did you invite us, us Mennonites, to you Muslims here in Iran, which of course, you know, they're kind of our enemies, you know. Why did you invite us? And among the reasons that that he gave, he said, well, first of all, you are a people of the book. We are too. It's a different one. But we recognize that you people are, you're different among Christians. You're not the average ones. You're different. You're a people of the book. And he said, secondly, we recognize that you come to us without a political agenda. You don't have guns. You don't have bombs. You don't have anything like that. Listen, at the very time that they were in Tehran talking to the people, to the Muslim clerics, United States, the State Department was trying very hard to get their own state personnel into Tehran to talk to the Iranian people, and they wouldn't listen. There were Mennonites there. They were talking. Why? Love your enemies. It's still the right idea. Lay not up treasure on heaven. I'm sorry, lay not up treasure on earth. Same passage. We have something to learn there. Lay it up in heaven. Could say more. Time will not permit. One other one that I cannot help but mention to you. But I say, stay committed until death. Now, of course, I paraphrased that just a bit. Our position on family, on life, on marriage, on its permanence is the right position. It is the right position. Let's not back down on it. I think I'm right on this. If you go back to 1920, and if you could solve this one issue alone, we would solve the America's problems with their fiscal deficit. Now, you think through this for just a moment. If this one issue alone, that is the breakup of families, and the approval that the Christian community has given to it, perhaps just tacit approval, but the approval that the Christian community has given has been a huge mistake in every way. The fiscal thing in the United States alone, I cannot imagine how much money will be spent today in the United States of America to solve that problem, just to address that problem. We've been right on this all along. Let's not back down. Be doers of the word and not hearers only. And we're talking about foundations. Can't help but reference Menno Simons here again, 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 11, his theme verse. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. And I want to conclude this point with that. I want to be very clear with you that we can make whatever adjustments we want to. We can I don't know, turn this knob, turn that knob, pull this lever, whatever. But Christ does need to be at the center and the core of all of this. I want to be very, very clear on that. Second passage that you're very familiar with, Matthew chapter 13, verses 1 to 9. The same day when Jesus out of the house and sat by the seaside, and great multitudes were gathered together unto him, so that he went into a ship and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. And he spake many things unto them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went forth to sow. And when he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Some fell upon stony places, for they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprung up, because they had no deepness of earth. I've underlined that in my Bible. The reason it sprung up is because they had no deepness of earth. And when the sun was up, they were scorched. And because they had no root, they withered away. Our subject this morning is infrastructure, building infrastructure. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprung up and choked them. And other fell into good ground and brought forth fruit, some 100-fold, some 60-fold, and some 30-fold. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear. It says in the King James Version. The explanation is given beginning at verse 18. And I'd like to talk about this a while, but we certainly just simply don't have time. But let me read the explanation. Hear ye therefore the parable of the sower, Jesus speaking. When anyone heareth the word of the kingdom and understandeth it not, then cometh the wicked one and catcheth away that which was sown in his heart. This is he which receives seed by the wayside. But he that received the seed into stony places, the same as he that heareth the word in anon, with joy receiveth it. And then in verse 21, I think, the tragedy. Yet hath he not root in himself. But dureth for a while, but when tribulation or persecution ariseth because of the word, by and by he is offended. He also that receives seed among the thorns is he that heareth the word, and the care of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becometh unfruitful. But he that receives seed into the good ground is he that heareth the word and understandeth it, which also beareth fruit and bringeth forth some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. This is a fascinating passage. I know you've heard it read 1,000 times probably and preached on maybe perhaps as many times. But let the significance of it sink deep into our hearts. What is the critical point here? The seed is good seed. I'm not here to challenge it. The sower is perfect. What then made the difference? The soil. The soil. Building the infrastructure of our communities. The same David Shank who went to Tehran, I also heard him say this kind of privately, and I hope he would not be offended if I say it here publicly. He said, well, you know what? It's still true that our best missionaries come from conservative circles. I have a question. Why is that true? Assuming it's true, why is it true? Well, I'm telling you, it's in this point right here. Soil, infrastructure, the hard work that goes into actually raising up a child and training that child until when he's a teenager, he's a 20-year-old or whoever it is, we can send him comfortably off to one of these boys' camps that a number of you are represented here. And these are the kind of people who can take a 13-year-old or who has gone astray and take them under their arms and care for them. My point is, that's a wonderful story, but somebody put hard, hard work into producing that kind of person. My second point is just very simple. We have always been keepers of the soil. Let's continue to be keepers of the soil. One of the native sons from this area wrote a book, The Earth is the Lord's. I think it was referenced already, John Ruth. And it talks about some of this. I'm a bit of an historian. I enjoy history. And you can't help but miss this as you, you have to hear it as you read the story of the Anabaptist people. I'm going to reference a story here right at the end of what I have to say this morning about a Russian Mennonite. But, you know, when you read some of these pieces, you're impressed. As the diaspora occurred in many of the almost all of us seated here this morning find our roots in a group of people who somewhere in the early 18th century or maybe even a little bit earlier decided to pull up roots, cross over the Atlantic Ocean, and land just about here where we're seated this morning. And much, of course, has gone on since that. At the same time, well, not at the same time, but about 50, 60 years later, 1780, beginning there and a little bit beyond, there was also another movement, and that was across northern Europe to the east. Out through what we know today as northern Germany and Poland, down along the Vistula River, there were Mennonites who went that way. Why did they? Well, primarily because they were keepers of the soil. They were good farmers. Now, I know I'm bragging up farming here a little bit, and we heard last night our brother saying, okay, let's not get too stuck there. We can live in cities and do well, too, and I agree. But this is part of our story, and let's not forget it. They went across northern Europe, down along the Vistula River there in Poland and beyond, visited some of the ruins there not all that long ago, and was really impressed. And finally, we had Catherine the Great, the Tsarina there from Russia, who invited them into Ukraine, and you know the story. I'll follow up on that story here right at the end. Back to my own life, if I can get said here in just a few minutes what needs to be said, I think. I grew up at a farm. What did I learn there? My dad had an eighth grade education, but my dad was one of the wisest men. He taught me things that our universities do not teach. He gave me some infrastructure that it took me years to figure this out, that it was a tremendous gift that almost nobody gets. But I got it. What did I get? I learned routine and schedule. I learned routine and schedule. I learned to get up in the morning and get at it. They would call it child abuse these days, but I was 6, 7 years old, and my dad dug us out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning and sent us out to the, well, we went along with him out to the barn, and we fed the calves, and we did this, and we did that, and we did the other thing. We came in, we ate breakfast, and we went off to school when we were old enough, and then we came home, and we did the same thing again, went out to the barn, and we worked. Routine and schedule. To this day, I can't sleep past 5 o'clock in the morning. Curse or bane, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is it has worked well for me. It's been a blessing in my life. It was a gift my dad passed on to me. Secondly, I learned perseverance there. I learned, my dad just simply said, you start a job, you finish it. This is back in the days when we were still driving 50-horsepower tractors, and you know, we'd go out into a field with a disc. Mind you, a 7-foot disc with a Farmo H or something like that. I think we had a 300 Farmo as well. We started around that field, and I don't know if you've ever done that or not, but we went round and round and round and round and round, and the day wore on, and we got thirsty, but there was nothing to do but just keep on going, just keep on going. And slowly but surely, that field, what needed to be done, would shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink. And you probably might not even get it done in one day, but 2-3 days, we'd get it done. Was there even a thought that you would give up? No. Not at all. You just stay there and you stay at it. It's part of our soil. Let's not throw it away. And third, I learned the value of good soil. She'll never forget. I had a neighbor lived right up the street from us. In fact, Sheila and I raised our family in this house. His name was Ralph McKenna. Good man. Psychology teacher at the local Wilson College here in Chambersburg where I grew up. And Ralph and my dad were good friends. Ralph was young, wore hair down to about here. My dad wore bib overalls and all that stuff that goes along with a good German farmer. And but Ralph and my dad got along well. He'd come down, talk to him, and we'd have good discussions and all that type of thing. And I'll never forget, one morning I was in the cow stable, and I was helping my dad milk the cows. It was light, and it was raining, mind you. My neighbor, Ralph, had bought a really nice Troy Belt rotor tiller, and I heard the Troy Belt running. And I looked out the window, and up there was Ralph doing his garden. It was raining. And I said to my dad, I said, Dad, why is Mr. McKenna rotor tilling his garden when it's raining? I wasn't but a 10-year-old or something like that, I don't know. And my dad said, oh, Ralph is a good man, but he just doesn't know that that's not what you should do. I learned the value of good soil. I learned that it takes something to raise, to grow a good garden. It takes hard work. You have to know the soil. But how should we define good soil? I have 3 words for you on this one: respect, sacrificial, and character. First one is respect for authority. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, I'm not sure where we're headed with this one. But we need to learn. If we need to make some course correction, let's make it. The Bible does not say, for no reason, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I used to wonder, why does he use that language? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. It says these kinds of things repeatedly. Why does he use fear? Why doesn't he say love? Well, love is a good word. But he says it for a reason, and that's because if you cannot learn to listen to a command and follow it, you can't get anywhere. I don't know how you feel about your parents. I don't know where you're at with those kinds of things, but I want to tell you something. That is a precious gift if somebody gives it to you, if they teach you that when a command is given, follow it. And you actually have the internal characteristic and the capacity to do such. It's amazing. Could say more there, need to move on. Sacrificial contributions to the community has been in our soil for a long time. Barn building, responses to disasters, financial responsibility, and I could tell a story there, I'll skip it. May I say, for whatever it's worth, sacrificial contributions to the community. It's counterintuitive to be church bashing. Mark that down. I don't really quite understand where we're headed with this. We find it somehow it's almost recreational to us to get into conversations where we pick out the things that are not going well and hammer on them. I acknowledge them. Be the first one to say, it's not like we don't have issues here at places. But brothers and sisters, it's counterintuitive to be church bashing. Our churches actually do fairly well in a lot of areas. I'm going to skip finally to the means of soil preparation. We have had basically three institutions that we have used to prepare soil, like I've been talking about. First one has been family, a second one is church, and the third one is school. And I think that's well represented here this morning. Just a short story here quickly from the family. I was in a conversation with one of my good friends who is not a Christian. And he was upbraiding me about not voting. In fact, he was a family member of mine. He said, Melvin, why don't you vote? I said, I do. He was astounded. I said, I vote with my life. I vote with my life. And I don't have time to tell you the entire conversation, but I bragged a little bit, and I'll just do it here. I said, okay, you can say what you want to say, but the fact of the matter is I have five sons. I have two daughters. My oldest son is an EMT, but his main job is he's in construction. My next son works for his brother, and he likes to take care of foster children. My third and fourth sons, they're teachers. In Christian schools. And my fifth son is graduating from high school this year. I have two daughters. They have one has four children, and the other one has four as well. And a fifth one on the way. And I told him, I said, you know what? None of my sons are expecting the government to pay them. None of them have gone to jail. Every one of them are productive citizens in the community. And I could say more here. But I said, don't tell me I don't vote. I vote with my life. The fact of the matter is, I want to make a difference. And by the way, this is just for you ladies. My wife is sitting over here. And at least, to me, this whole group gathered here is the ladies, the moms in this audience are as responsible for what you see here as anybody else. I give at least 50%, if not 60, 70% of whatever success I have been sits over there. Don't take a second seat because you're a stay-at-home mom. That's been part of our soil, a very, very integral part. Can't help but just mention that I was never so irritated as when I got a piece in the mail from the Social Security office where they were telling me all this stuff, and my wife got one too, and her whole paper read zeros from top to bottom. I threw the thing in a waste paper can with a little bit of anger and said, so that's how the government views a woman who would change diapers, pay attention to the details, take care of me, feed me, see to it that I have a nice, comfortable place and all of that, and raise seven children. Come on. School, FB, school's represented here. I'm sorry, I just have to skip that piece right now, but I just want to say it's part of the infrastructure. Brothers and sisters, let's pay attention to our schools. And finally, I'll just tell you a story to close here this morning. The story is about one of those Russian Mennonites after years had gone by. His name was Aaron Rempel. And again, the Russian Mennonites have gotten a bad rap, I think, in some ways. Aaron Rempel was a rich farmer in the Ukraine. Lived in the early 20th century. Aaron had a farm, had a family, World War I, Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. And in that very year, Aaron Rempel was in town at Nadenfeld picking up some groceries for his family. And as he was going home that evening, and it was just beginning to get dark, he passed a railroad tracks, and on the railroad tracks was a train with a number of cattle cars on. And on those cattle cars were some of the Reds. Those of you who know the history, the whites versus the Reds during about this time. And so these were communists. They were on the cars and being transported somewhere. And while Aaron was walking, he heard the cries for help. Food! Food! We're hungry! So he clambered up across the embankment, and there was a hand come out through the slats, and he reached into his bag, and he gave them some sausages and some cheeses or whatever it is, and the hands kept coming out, so he kept handing it out till it was all empty. Went home, said to the family, I'm sorry, I went to the grocery store, but I came home with nothing. Time went on, and eventually the communists began to get the upper hand, as you know, and began to train their guns, as it were, on the Mennonites there in Ukraine. Sure enough, Aaron Rempel and his family were gathered together, put on train cars, shipped east to Siberia. Aaron Rempel was an entrepreneur. And so he wasn't in Siberia very long until he realized that, in fact, you could sell tea here. That's a cold place. Hot tea is a good thing. So he started a little business, mind you. Big mistake in communist Russia. To make a long story short, within a certain period of time, he was turned in and arrested because of his capitalistic ventures of selling tea and making a living there in Siberia for him and his family. Went to court, expected to be executed, really because that's what the deal was in those days. Appeared, as I understand it, twice. First of all, to be arraigned, and second of all, to be sentenced. That is sentencing. As he was standing there in front of the judge, the comrade, as it were, looked down at him and began to read off his sentence, and then looked at him again and said, "Say, haven't I seen you before? Haven't we met before?" "I don't know." "You happen to be from Nadenfeld?" "Yeah." "You remember a night? A cattle car, hands, hunger, food?" "Yeah." "We have met. I was that man." This is his judge. He said, I tell you what, it's in my power to do with you whatever needs to be done. How would you like to immigrate to the United States? You did me a turn, I'll do you one." Aaron, being a good family man, said, "Great. But could you give me immigration papers for the rest of the family as well?" And he did. The Rempel family and its the offspring still live in California. God bless you and have a good day.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders Educational Programs. Order online at www.christianlearning.org. Or call 877-222-4769.